Welcome. This is, I don't know what number we are, but this is a... It's
272.
It's session 272. welcome to, actually, the final stop on the Our Voices, Our Visions Tour. We thought the final stop of the Our Visions, Our Voices Tour was here in Salt Lake in March, but we're so glad to be back at Sunstone to kind of reprise a little bit for you. My name is Joanna Brooks. I'll chair this session and do a little bit of reading. And I'm really pleased to have with me four fantastic Mormon women writers who participated in the tour. And I'll tell you a little bit about them now before I tell you about the tour itself. With us today is Julie Nichols, who's an associate professor of creative writing in the Department of English and Literature at Utah Valley University. She has an MA and a BA in English from BYU and a PhD in fiction from the University of Utah. She's grandmother to some of the most beautiful children on the planet, it says right here. She's still married to the same guy, and Humble Relief Society president in the Provo Ward, where she's lived most of her life, which makes her probably the best-adjusted person at the front of the room. She hasn't written fiction since her first novel, Bit the Dust, 3 years ago, but there are some fine feminist prize-winning stories in her past in both Sunstone and Dialogue. Creative nonfiction is also won her some recognition. Next to Julie is the incomparable Holly Welker. She has an MFA in poetry from the University of Arizona and a PhD in literature from the University of Iowa. Her poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and scholarship have appeared in publications ranging from The New Era to The New York Times to Best American Essays to Bitch, and I consider her one of the most important Mormon women writing today. The current project she's working on is putting together an anthology of Mormon women writers discussing Mormonism's attitudes towards marriage. Born and raised in southern Arizona, she now lives and writes in northern Utah, right here, in fact, just down the street. Elisa Pulido, I'm proud to introduce. Her poetry has appeared in River Styx, The Ledge, another Chicago magazine, Margie, the North American Review, and Rhino in the U.S., and in Interchange and the New Welsh Review in the United Kingdom. She's an honorary member of the Academy Cardiff, the National Literary Society of Wales. She has a bachelor's degree in German from BYU, an MFA from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and is currently pursuing a doctoral degree in religious studies at Claremont Graduate University. And finally, Elizabeth Pinborough spent 5 years of her childhood in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and the rest of her years growing up here in Zion. An undergraduate at BYU, she revisited her Kentucky roots by researching, or having a love affair with, she says, the Shakers. And the fruit of that project included her sole poetry publication, A Shaker Sisters Hymnal, which appeared in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. After graduating from BYU in 2007 with a degree in literature, she interned at the Joseph Smith Papers Project and applied to graduate programs. She landed at Yale Divinity School, where she has completely landed. Talk about understatement. She landed at Yale Divinity School. She was brilliant enough to get into Yale Divinity School, where she is completing a master's degree in religion and literature. She participates in a weekly poetry workshop called Ink Wings with other divinity students. Oil painting, sacred harp singing, and photography are among her favorite pastimes and stress relievers. And my name is Joanna Brooks, and I'll be chairing the session. If you're curious about who I am, you can read the blurb in the program. Just some background for the session today. We're going to hope to give you a little bit of the experience that we all had this last spring when we organized the Our Voices, Our Vision Mormon Women's Literary Tour. And here's the background story on that. In August 2008, so about 2 years ago, this month, I had this vision. Humbly put, I am a Mormon after all. We have visions. And I emailed a woman writer I had never met before, but who I had admired from afar, maybe even had a girl crush on from afar. Her name is Holly Welker. I said, Holly, I have this crazy vision, and here it is. You know, what if we get together a bunch of Mormon women writers and we take it on the road? And it can be kind of like Thelma Louise, you know, meets Lollapalooza, meets Sunstone, or something like that. Let's see how it goes. I said, will you do it with me? And she said, yes. And so we began. And my motivations at that point were that I had been away, even though I had been writing about Mormonism from the time I was really young, like published at home in the front when I was 8, you know, and through my early 20s, I had taken about 10 years off from writing about Mormonism, from being in LDS liberal circles as an active participant, and I was lonely, and I was curious about who was writing. And I was also entering a new phase in my life where I wanted to create opportunities for younger women writers, women who would have been in the same position I was in, you know, when I was in my early 20s. I wanted to create ops here, what fresh new voices were out there. And then finally, I wanted to create a platform for Mormon women that would work across some of the divides that have conventionally carved up not only Mormon tradition, but Mormon writing, across denominational divides, across divides of orthodoxy versus unorthodoxy, across Community of Christ, RLDS, mainstream LDS, fundamentalists, LDS, and across observant, non-observant, any woman that was willing to identify with Mormonism, that was willing to identify with our beautiful tradition and call her a Mormon, I wanted her in the project. And, you know, something that happens in Mormon writing a lot is Mormon literature a lot, and that we've seen it in some of the debates online around Brady Udall's novel Lonely Polygamist is, you know, oftentimes we judge our fiction as if we're giving each other a temple recommend interview. You know, like if something happens in the book that's kind of human but maybe not, is it Mormon literature? Is it worthy of the tradition? And that pressure, I wanted that also to disappear. We just wanted to create a big tent and see who showed up. And so that's what Holly and I did. We put out a call for papers. We put it out anywhere we could imagine a Mormon woman writer might find it. We put it out through faculties of MFA programs across the country to find people. We tried to circulate it in fundamentalist LDS communities. It was posted on Brooke Adams' blog, The Plural Life. She's a beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune that covers fundamentalist communities. We circulated it through Community of Christ circles as best we could. Put it out through the Gay and Lesbian Community Center here in Salt Lake. Anyone who identifies as a Mormon, we wanted to be a part of them. We wanted to be a part of the project. And then we also started organizing readings at universities. And it was really important to me since I make my living as a professor, I'm an academic. You know, I know how it's my assessment that Mormon women's literature, Mormon literature in general, and Mormon studies in general as well, are undervalued at universities. And, you know, I thought, you know, there are millions of us in the United States. We deserve a place. We deserve an institutionalized place. We deserve institutional resources. We matter. So we started organizing readings at universities as well as a part of this. And then finally, our third goal was to build an archive. So we developed a component of the project where any woman who came to any of the readings we were planning could bring anything that she had written, and it would go in our box, and we carried this box through the whole tour, and the work we collected was finally deposited at the University of Utah Special Collections Library. And our goal was to create an archive of what actual Mormon women were thinking and writing, you know, at the turn of the 21st century. Because I'm a literary historian, and I know how wonderful it is when there's an archive from the past that you can, like, turn to make such a rich find. So we wanted to create that. So thanks to the generosity of many, many Mormon women and men throughout the Book of Mormon Belt, what materialized at long last was a tour that was 5 campuses, 6 days, 14 women writers. We started at Claremont, we went to Arizona State University, we read at Southern Utah University, we read at Utah Valley University, thanks to Julie, and we read at the University of Utah, no thanks to the U of U English Department who wanted to charge us money for renting a room, but many thanks to, no one else did that, only them, but many thanks to the U of U Honors Program, which is headed by a fine Mormon feminist named Martha Bradley. So, anyway, through the tour, many of us had, for me it was certainly what I would characterize as a life-changing experience. We were hosted, taken care of, treated beautifully by Mormon women at every stop along the way, welcomed into people's homes, fed, cared for. We met a diverse range of Mormon women writers. We had a pink calico pioneer bonnet we took pictures of with everyone along the way. You can visit my Facebook page and the album is up. At one point when we got lost, we even took some rocks we collected from, like, a beach in California, put them in the bonnet. So, we have peep stones in our bonnet now. We can find our way through on the highway. And one of the most remarkable things that happened, actually, to us was a very unscripted moment. It was important to us to try and do some outreach to fundamentalist Mormon communities. And we didn't necessarily have the best connections. That we didn't have great connections. And so at our reading at ASU, we met someone who had done some work in those communities as part of his employment and offered to connect us with women he'd worked with very closely in Centennial Park, Arizona, who were members not of the FLDS church, but of an off offshoot branch of the Mormon fundamentalism. And so we went to Colorado City, and we were taken in, fed, you know, fresh hot scones with homemade pear jam, and hosted, taken on a tour in a van, a giant family van, they drive them too, just like us, of Colorado City, Hilldale, Centennial Park, and we, they invited us into one of their homes, and at that point it was four of us, it was Holly, me, Susan Scott, who is a remarkable part of the tour story, a Community of Christ woman from Canada, who flew out to join us for the event, for the tour. Holly, me, Susan, and Lisa Hadley, who's affiliated with Exponent 2 and lives in Boston, spent an evening, several hours in conversation with a group of five women from the Centennial Park community. They call themselves the Work of Jesus Christ, plurally married women. And we had a very open, warm, funny. Holly at one point made jokes about herself and how she looks like a polygamist when she wears her long skirts and does her hair a certain way.
I looked like a frumpy polygamist, I did.
Yeah.
Is that word frumpy?
Yeah.
Yes,
they cracked
yes,
up. They loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah. And well, actually, what happened was they said, we took one look at you and we knew you were safe. And I said, that's because I look like a frumpy polygamist. And they just thought
laughed.
That was
they just
the
laughed.
Funniest thing.
And we had the most warm, open, wonderful conversation. And that was life-changing, right? As a Mormon woman who's lived all of her life with the idea of the theological prospect of polygamy always in the back of my head, right? Will there be polygamy? What does that mean? Actually meeting these women who, for whom this was an Orthodox religious commitment they felt very good about making was a life-changer for me. It was a wonderful experience. They subsequently gave us reams of writing, reams of poetry, for the archive we created, including poetry about Heavenly Mother. They were shocked to hear that women had been disciplined in the mainstream LDS church for praying to Heavenly Mother, because she is a more articulate part of their theology. I mean, we could tell you, we could go on for hours about our experience in Colorado City, but it was one of the most wonderful, unexpected aspects of this tour. And we had at the same table a woman from the Community of Christ, a woman, you know, Mormon fundamentalist woman and mainstream LDS woman. I think that's probably the first time that's happened, maybe ever. So we were very proud of that incredible good fortune. Anyway, so without further ado, that's the background. That's what happened. Let's get into the reading experience again. So let's all pretend it's, you know, springtime, and you've come to the final reading of the Our Voices, Our Visions tour. And every tour event, we began in the same way, with a collective poem. And we asked everyone in the room to start by saying the name of their grandmother out loud, all in sequence, to kind of acknowledge our Mormon history, celebrate it, and to celebrate the women who make up our lineage and brought us here to this moment. So we thought we'd start this by doing that again. So are you ready? Because we're going to voice the first poem together. And so I'll each say my grandmother's name is. Okay, so I'll start. And then should we go this way?
Two
and then
grandmas.
You pick one. Well, and we'll finish with Lisa, okay? My grandmother's name is America Pearl Thornton Leonis.
My grandmother's name is Gertrude Zakely. My grandmother's name is Eva Lillian Cragen Heiner.
My grandmother's name is Virginia Davis.
My grandmother's name is Lucy Elizabeth Carroll.
My grandmother's name is Emily Elmira Hoyt.
My grandmother's name is Mary Myrtle Ballard Scherzer.
My grandmother's name is Isolina Falky.
My grandmother's name is June Ray Glenn.
My grandmother's name is Francie Gardner Hunter.
My grandmother's name is Mary Ann Thompson Michelle Weiler.
My grandmother's name is Thelma Sheffield.
My grandmother's name is Alice.
My grandmother's name is Lori Tiger Eastman.
My grandmother's name is Lois Erickson.
My grandmother's name is Genevieve Call.
My grandmother's name is Mary Tressa Larson Green.
My grandmother's name is Shirley Askew Reader.
My grandmother's name is Bonita Quintana Thompson Loyhart.
My grandmother's name is Elizabeth Bates Smith Baum.
My grandmother's name is Elisa Price Smith. My grandmother's name is Jessie Miller Harris.
My grandmother's name is Bella Bullock Miller.
My grandmother's name is Shirley Ann Underwood Conway.
My
grandmother's name is Alice Vince Pinborough.
My grandmother's name is Stella Maria Carolina Anderson.
My grandmother's name is Fanny Irene Corbett Nielsen.
My grandmother's name is Persis Minerva McKee.
My grandmother's name is Esther Kemple Klein.
My grandmother's name is Karen Elizabeth Christensen Frederickson.
My grandmother's name is Jean Bang Livingston Cook.
My grandmother's name is Mary Weir Calderwood Hunter.
My grandmother's name is Terza Desdemona Fisk Cox.
My grandmother's name is Constance Eugene Wallace Eastwood.
My grandmother's name is Madeline Jane Snowball.
My grandmother's name is Minerva Bernetta Kohlheb Tykert.
Thank you. You have created the first poem in our reading today. Thank you all very much. We're going to begin today with, this is the order you'll hear the readers in first. We'll hear from Julie Nichols, then from Elisa Polito, then from Elizabeth Pinborough, then from Holly Welker, and then I'll do a brief conclusion. So, Julie.
Welcome, everyone. I appreciate your being here. This piece of fiction, please be aware it's fiction, was published in the winter 2006 dialogue. It's called Without Number, and that is, of course, a reference to Moses 1 and 33, and worlds without number have I created, and I also created them for mine own purpose. Up already, my father said, here early to fetch my husband. Developers and investors always on the lookout, they were on their way to Idaho for a site check. Late fall 1978. Baby keeping you awake? Haven't been to sleep, I said, rueful. I handed him his morning postum, and he nursed it, letting warmth seep into his big working man's hands, waiting at the counter for Paul to come downstairs. On B Street in Salt Lake City, November in the Carter years, everything spelled safety. Well-dusted furniture, vacuumed rugs, lint-free drapes, shining stovetop. Remote threats, distant uncertainties, all bided their time. Dad loved my husband. Both of them loved me. There was a baby, Christopher, and another on the way, Katie. And I, the best-trained technical writer at Thiokol, knew that I would never want for food, shelter, or community. The minute I wanted to quit working outside the home, I could. So what's bothering you? I shrugged. This and that. Little things. Sometimes little things add up, he said. Just don't let it go too far. Hey, Paul. My husband stood at the landing, ready to go. Careful, unsecure. I'd been out with Paul just twice when my father, his boss at Layton Construction, told me confidentially, better marry that one. Your mother'd approve. Never seen a better worker. From my father, there was no higher compliment. Sometimes, during the 70s, I imagined scenarios where my mother bestowed her highest compliments. Never heard a funnier storyteller, or never saw a more talented artist. Well, it was possible, but I didn't check with Dad about that. Enough for him that she'd been a saint. Prettiest girl in her class at the U, Lambda Del Prez. Stalwart supporter of city and church. Her death was the tragedy of his life. And I was the light of it. By the time I graduated from their alma mater with an emphasis in technical writing so I'd never be without a job, although secretly I devoured women's lit so I'd never be without friends. By the time I graduated, my father, accustomed to Paul's extreme competence, made him head accountant and urged me to join that partnership. You let him take you to the temple, he said. He'll take care of you for eternity. Nobody was surprised at our announcement. Paul accepted the stocks as a wedding gift, but beyond that, he said he wouldn't take any more than he earned. So my father had to find ways to give us everything he wanted to. When we burst through the bronze doors of the Manti Temple, my father pulled us aside even before the photographer could snap us kissing in the summer heat. Here, he said, cramming the manila envelope into Paul's hands. Small token of my confidence, son. I know my daughter's never going hungry. Christopher was born in April. Thiokol gave me a forward-looking 3-month maternity leave. What impressed my father was their request that I return, their offer to pay for childcare. His daughter must be good at what she did. Now, you know your mother took care of you till the day she died, he told me, bobbling the baby in the Land's End Chase Lounge as Paul mowed the lawn and I harvested early beans. You really think you need a nanny? Women have always helped each other raise their babies, I said lightly, snapping beans into a bowl. Help with little things. Just like you have assistants, vice presidents, same thing. He tried to chuckle. If your mother was alive, she'd take the baby for you, Paul said. My father winced. But she's not, so what are you going to do? Good question, Dad said. What do you want in a nanny? Young and good-looking, or old and experienced? He winked at Paul. Well-read, I said. Paul grunted. My father said, I'll have my secretary find somebody to fill the bill. Every weekday for nearly a year, at the end of my drive home, Nina was waiting there with chili or chops and a perfectly contented child. Like me, she had a degree in something from some university. Unlike me, she didn't use it to make her living. For all I knew, Nina's whole business in life was to come to my house, feed my child, clean my sink, make the meals my husband and I ate together. Having cued me in all my lines concerning the baby's progress, his crawling, his walking, his baby speech, she would slip quietly away, leaving us to our scenario of willing compliance, Paul and his wife. Do you read? I asked Nina sometime in January or February. Christopher was hauling himself along the coffee table, precocious. His father was in Arizona. All the time, she said. You? When I told her I read fiction on my breaks, she said, sure, to improve your technical style. A good tech writer needs acquaintance with multiple worlds. I reached just in time to keep Christopher upright as he came to the end of the sofa. You do. That's for sure, she said. You live in about 5 that I can see. This interested me. Tell, I said. Your dad's world. She held up her left thumb, which Christopher grabbed. Your husband's, the index finger. Your work, that's a whole world unto itself. Another finger pointing at me. This house. And then there's all that literature you read, worlds inside those pages. Christopher swayed, pulling on her splayed hand. Want to know what I read? This is Nina. Astrology books. She jiggled the baby patiently. Does that freak you out? Hey, I watch the stars at night, I said. She stood scooping up my boy. Come here, she said, grabbing my hand. We made our way out to the gazebo, looking south over the city sprawled across the valley. That's my world. One world, you'd think. Salt Lake City, 1977. Unified. Harmonious. Uh-huh, I said, rubbing the baby's back, watching the lights. But no. I could see her breath. Her eyes, light blue, were bright in the cold. No, I said, shivering. There's one. That's your world, too, she said, pointing west toward Temple Square. I was born into it as well, but I'll bet you don't even know about Cosmic Aeroplane. That's 2. or Mormons for ERA. That's three. My teeth were beginning to chatter. The baby's cheeks reddened in the chill. Gilgal. That's a whole thing, too. You know Gilgal? A sphinx with the head of Joseph Smith? Right down there in the middle of town. There are worlds in this town. Fierce, she was. It surprised me. Let's get Christopher inside, I said. I feed him vitamins. He won't catch cold. I might, though, I said. You might, she said. I think you're catching something already. On the afternoon of the day my father went with Paul to Idaho, with which we began this reading, a dark twilight 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, I made my way to the parking lot, gnawing a cracker, holding off nausea. A storm was coming. The sky bled black behind the plant, an opacity on the horizon west and north, racing me home. I hunched over the steering wheel, tensing myself for the onslaught of that darkness, that hard wall of thunderhead stripping the sky of light. It seemed a sign. I must tell Paul that I was pregnant and take the consequences. If he and my father said that with two children I must stop working, I would. But what? The wind flung dust and debris against the van, pattering, jittering, setting records a little further north. You can look it up still and find the reports. Roofs blown off, damage from limbs and litter. At home. Bad night, said Nina as she took my coat. I shook my hair out, stretching my neck left and then right. Pretty bad, I said. But the place looks great. It always did. Clean, but not too clean. Traces of the baby's dinner in the sink, the skillet of something on the stove, good jazz on KUER, soft light in the big room holding the wind at bay. Your dad and your husband both called, she said. They won't be back tonight. Your dad's in Ogden. Paul's in Pocatello. He'll call later. Okay, I said. Then will you stay? It came out like that, unpredictable. All night? I didn't say no. We bathed Christopher together, laughing at his babbling. I read him Goodnight Moon till he dozed on the floor, and then sleepily we watched television late into the night. When the phone rang, almost at midnight, we both jumped. I'll be here in Pokey 2 nights, Paul said. Is there anything I need to know? Everything's fine. Take your time, I told him. Christopher stirred at my voice. I got up to rock him. And Nina lay back, stretching. That baby, she said. He has a great horoscope. Did you know? I drew it up one day when he was sleeping. Moon in his 7th house, Jupiter in his 1st. Lucky, just like his mom. She rolled off the waterbed and took him from me. I watched her dark shape as she left our room, laid Christopher in his bed and wandered back, graceful, strong. Surely my mother's was a presence like that. She put her hands on my shoulders and kneaded deep into my neck and up behind my ears. Her hands. I reached up to them. Held them. She bent down, kissed my cheek. Everything's just fine, she said. Is it? I said. Believe it, she said, lifting me by the hand. Now come on, come to bed. Thank you, I said, and went with her. There was comfort in her arms. I slept, oblivious to the hurtling storm, the starless, heavy skies to the west, to the north. The cover in all directions, black, massive, dangerous. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. Thank you to Sunstone and to Joanna and Holly for organizing this great event. I'm going to read a poem this afternoon that I haven't read in public before. In fact, I only wrote it this week. Okay. And so, going to school, I don't get much time to write, but I'm going to read this. It's called Emma Waiting, September 22nd, 1827. And it's a poem about Emma Smith waiting at the base of the Hill Cumorah while the prophet Joseph Smith goes up to get the plates. And it's a prose poem in 8 sections. 1. It's after midnight on a moonless night when the holy man and his bride arrive in a one-horse wagon at the base of the hill. Up in the canopy, Kimura's katydids strum a potent meditation for honeymooners, or perhaps even holy men who have been called into the night by angelic beings. The holy man hands his wife the reins, leaves her in starlight in a wagon borrowed without permission. 2. Hoping for grace, benedictions, powers, plates, the holy man begins his steep climb into God's realm. His wife hears him rustle through Indian pipe and lady fern. Beneath the katydid's clamor, she imagines the chirping of tiny shrews in the underlitter, surprised by the holy man's footfall. On the holy man goes, higher and higher. The wife of the holy man imagines him weaving through aspen, white pine, and beech. She hears a porcupine chat out a warning. She imagines him jumping aside, and finally, when she thinks the holy man must be somewhere near the top of the hill, she imagines him parting tall millet grass, then stepping through squirrel corn into a hilltop clearing. In expectation, the wife of the holy man searches the starlit tree line for signs. Low-lying clouds, phosphorescence, sudden breezes, thunder. She sees nothing, hears the horse munching weeds. An hour goes by. The katydids fall silent. At least, thinks the holy man's wife, at least it is the beginning of autumn. Mosquitoes and deer flies are not what they were. She stretches, tries to step down again from the wagon, and startles something that hisses. She retreats to her seat and says a prayer for the holy man. Another hour and it's cooler now. Dew begins to collect on the bonnet and shawl of the holy man's wife. Her feet are cold. She envies deer mice nesting in trunks, finches roosting close to each other. Where, she asks, where is the holy man? A hoot owl asks a different question. Who marries a holy man? The stars have dimmed, and there is still no sign of the holy man. His wife portends the tale of her life in a litany of roadside weeds. Gypsy weed, henbit nettles, old witch panic, nightshade. The wife of the holy man has a stiff neck. Hours ago she gave off hoping to hear the voice of God, but still yearns for the voice of the holy man. The reins grow heavy in her hands. She no longer hears the crack, the creak of the wagon box, the swish of horsetail. She dozes upright. At last, it is dawn. First a whippoorwill calls, then songbirds join in. They trill, chirp, warble, chorus, exult. Wake up! Wake up! Another holy man descends from his mount with a new covenant. The wife of the holy man stirs. Though she does not hear him yet, though she does not yet see him, she feels saplings give way to his touch. Pheasants startled by beauty. I had a couple of requests. My sister's here, and she taught a lesson on Elijah last week in Sunday school, so I'm reading this poem on Elijah. Elijah. Let's name him Elijah, I said. Perhaps our cruse of oil will never run out. Maybe there will always be a little more flour in the blue and white canister on the kitchen counter. If it gets that bad, the crows may feed us, and should one of us die, he might revive us. We named him Elijah. His seat at the dinner table is always vacant. He curses authority figures and six dogs on the elderly. In our home, there is a famine of quiet words. He calls down flames on parental warning and squeals away from the house nightly in his chariot of fire. this poem, there was a session on, I forget the name of the paper, it was Matt, I believe, Bowden, who read a paper on Bigfoot and Cain, and how in Mormon folklore, Bigfoot has been associated with Cain. So I told him he's not here, but I said I would read this poem I wrote a while ago called Troglodytophobia, which is about Bigfoot. When we consider eyewitness testimony of the North American Sasquatch loping along Louisiana's highways, reports of encounters in East Central Alabama, the Hoosier National Forest, Texas, Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, Colorado, from coast to coast and north to south, when we consider Bigfoot has been sighted nationally and internationally, named and renamed all over the world, Flintville Monster, Ruuguru, Florida Swamp Ape, Yowie Rock Ape, Jungle Man, Yeti, Jinger, Abominable Snowman, etc. When we weigh all of these facts, allowing for, mind you, probable regional variants in color, height, and mass, the total lack of artifacts, nesting sites, folkloric tradition, and anecdotal evidence of hirsute bipedal hominids in the state of Kansas presents itself as one of cryptozoology's greatest mysteries. Personally, I can think of just two explanations. If we were to use Occam's razor, the simplest answer being the correct answer, we would have to conclude, as Sasquatch prefers wooded areas, and as the state is particularly unwooded, Bigfoot finds Kansas an unsuitable habitat. No cover, no branches to break as markers. The other possibility, Bigfoot is already in Kansas and no one is talking. Perhaps Kansans who do not court ridicule and who know how to keep their own counsel never think of Bigfoot. If no one thinks of Bigfoot, does he cease to exist? After the 1994 sighting of a Sasquatch near St. Petersburg, Russian psychologist Valentin Sapanov suggested the form and fear of large hairy men, troglodytophobia, is imprinted in the human brain before birth. He claims this instinctual fear has given the rise to legends of King Kong, of Bigfoot. In the April edition of Psychology Today, Dr. Kirk Alley asserts all of us have an inner wild man we spend most of our lives repressing. Kansans, he says, a polite, clean people, still willing to give their bus seats to the infirm and elderly, have so bound the inner wild man they are blind to all species of primate except man. His conclusion, should Bigfoot ever cross into Kansas and pause at dusk on the back stoop of a farmhouse and meet through an open window the inexorable gray gaze of one of the state's stolid, aproned, bipedal hominids, quietly rinsing supper's dishes, he would immediately shave himself, dress, and go looking for a job. Okay. Thank everyone for coming. I've been to poetry readings where maybe two people show up, and this is nice. Thank you. So I think I have time for one more poem. So I'm going to read a poem called Poetry in Paradise and Perdition. And so now I'm wondering how they write poetry in paradise, paper and pen falling through diaphanous hands as they would, and speech no longer necessary. Lines naturally composed of light, a pink here and varying shades of purple, red, or yellow there, and stanzas going supernova at a reading, bursting across the galaxy, consuming everything in their path, passing through the spirits of the worthy, the attendees. And these same spirits clasping their weightless hands and turning cartwheels in the throes of ecstasy, and after the reading, the attendees surrounding the poet and thumping her on the back with congratulatory thought. And so now I'm wondering how they write poetry in perdition, light regionally absent as of course it would be, unable to find writing implements in the dark, the spirits of the damned compose the poetry of regret using available resources. Heavy verses of clay pushed uphill, slip, slide, roll down, and quash, fragile metaphors carved from peat and ash last only moments. Layers of sediment in jam, line upon never-ending line, and at the hellish reading, the attendees form a line, sobbing and sighing as they braille past, braille past, braille past. Thank you.
So I'm going to read a couple of sort of short prose pieces, and then a poem, and then read some of the infamous Shaker poem that I've forced many of you to listen to more than once. sort of the unifying theme of these pieces is different versions of womanhood. I found her among clusters of novelty purses and overpriced picture frames, a naked lady in the hinterlands of a Cleveland novelty shop. She stretched a piece of chiffon coiled across her nose with upraised hands. Her crimson lips pressed the fabric ever so lightly. Her eyes beckoned. The dark centers of her breasts overwhelmed the white landscape of her body, a pair of Galilean moons. I stared. I looked away. I couldn't fathom nakedness, at least not nakedness displayed in this way. Part of me fell away, and the rest of me changed forever. Mattress springs beneath my back and legs lift me. I am floating, weighted down by a thick lace coverlet. Sunlight filters through vinyl blinds. A misty, waterish light surrounds me. I put off the coverlets. I rise. The bathroom is around the corner. Across the carpeted threshold, my feet touch gray tile, colder than riverbed stones. My legs barely reach the floor as I sit on the toilet, my crusty eyes trying to comprehend, despite the blue light, a tub, toes, sink, stack of the Reader's Digest. A few linoleum inches away from my feet, an armored insect curls its spiky tail. Somehow my frozen voice thaws. My grandmother enters, heroic warrior, to smash the offensive insect with her shoe. Death banished, I weakly stumble back to bed. A feeling in my heart as black as my grandmother's black hair, curled into a regal bun. The metaphor comes. It circles my brainstem and settles there, becoming a tumor or a lung. Mountains. I think about mountains. Steepled peaks, peaked people breathing air more pure than mine. A lion loosed from her mountain home found her way into a foothill suburb. She attacked two little girls riding their tricycles. The policeman said he could see the cat's ribs beneath her mangy fur and leathery skin. From the window, the mother stared with glassy eyes as the news crew arrived. She felt a tightening in her chest, as though an invisible hand were testing the strength of her heart. And the Shaker Sisters hymnal came out in Dialogue in 2009, I think, summer. And I felt very lucky to have it published. The sections of this poem are titles of Shaker hymnals, and it's about a girl's sort of spiritual journey. Who will bow and bend like the willow? As I walk to meeting across the grass, angels alight on windows and eaves. They are hymning and praising and comforting the bereaved. Behind me I feel the airy shuffle, hear the woolen ruffle, sense the white presence of vanished brothers and sisters. With an echoing crack, I stumble on the granite meeting house stoop. Under the cerulean ceiling we stand, like spires, until a single voice rings out the hollow, low, lodal, 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 low, lodal, low. Now the spires start to move. We stomp our soles with ringing clomp as we slowly pace in circular pairs. The floor quakes as the room shakes. I labor and clap, march and sing. I hear the beat of angels' wings. I traverse the verse of every song, swept along by movement and voice. I whirl and bend in vision's current strong. Pleasant walk. The room revolves as the sky dissolves. My bodily sense has long since been spent. A new landscape appears, a veil is rent, and I see a world beyond the ken of human eyes. A towering mulberry tree appears, its leaves are crosswise intertwined. Beneath the tree a table stands with exotic fruit, delicate wine. I sit at the table and drink until it spills from my lips. Straightway I see a dwelling place, peerless in its form and grace. Within, angels give me garments new and present me with fine trinkets, colored balls and jeweled boxes, not a few. Here, spirits dance in union sweet. Between them, I see a staircase rise. It spirals and spirals toward unseen skies. A rushing wind flies from its heights and sweeps me, breathless to its climb. The universal star shines above. Its amber light suffuses sight. My feet are led from step to step. Below me, dwellings constellate, forming a geometric homestead. A gold gate gleams ahead. Sisters and eldresses await me there. With joyous shouts, they urge me on, guiding me with eager care. I stretch and reach to touch their hands, but cannot shake my earthly bands. Sudden mists cloud my eyes, and I fall through the hands of the dead. I'm on my way to Zion. The autumn sky dyes in purple silk, while the moon wanes scarlet, saffron, and pearl. A clock is ticking on the wall like the ringing echo of soft footfalls. My painted floor is grooved and worn from nights of marching, treading thorns, yet lines of copper nails still shine, small stars planted in the pine wood.
So, as Joanna mentioned, 2 years ago she emailed me and she said, I need your organizational skills and I want you to cross the desert. And I said, here's my shoulder, give me a wheel to put it against. And we spent a year and a half organizing this gig and a beautiful friendship was born. And the work is ongoing, right? We still have plans. And if you have interest in helping us host another one somewhere, we want to talk to you. All right, I'm going to read a few things. So, this is called Sanctuary. A couple of weeks ago, a few of my friends had a bat flying around loose in their house. At the same time, I had some astronomers flying around loose in my life, and I came to the conclusion that bats and astronomers are essentially the same species, dark hairy mammals that flap around in the night and make feeble attempts to detect what's in their universe by sending out radio or sound waves and trying to interpret the waves that bounce back. You might be intrigued by their activities, but there's no point in trying to have a relationship with one because they're among nature's most profoundly inarticulate creatures. That's the version I told my friends, but here's the one I tell myself. After so many years of singing to console myself, it seemed right to stand up and sing in joy, but he hushed me and had me lie down on my back. This is the usual way, he said. He was always saying things like that, as if silence required commentary or assistance. The usual way for what? If I had known what narcissism was, I would have recognized it, not in his long, intentionally careless hair, but in his delight in sitting me down when it grew dark and explaining to me things like the apparent closeness of two heavenly bodies. Look, he would say, and point his fine hand at any number of stars or planets. But he himself was not looking at the sky. He was watching my gaze reluctantly leave his face and move down his arm. He was noticing that I found his hand more amazing than any constellation of light. When I went to China, someone named me Yu, short for universe. It was a joke and not a joke to tell that to an astronomer. It was a joke and not a joke to believe Chinese words could also mean things in English. According to my dictionary, a woman who dwells with a tiger is a virgin, and to kill someone also means to tighten a belt. I own far too many belts, and I have never liked them loose. One textbook told me, students must learn to distinguish bone chips from dust. Since then, I have constantly confused those things and seen the night scattered on the floor of a butcher shop, unable to collect itself and terrified by its own grief, while the sky gives itself over to useless bits of bone, glinting and smugly divorced from live flesh. If only I had known what sanctuary meant, I might not have asked God to grant me a lover. I might not have asked my lover to grant me a place to dwell. I might not have opened the door of my dwelling to that small black tiger who burns all day asleep on my pillow and yowls all night for French meat. My lover was a coward, I'll grant that. Terrified by my stories of the butcher shop, afraid of the arrogant bones he was drawn to, upset when he saw that at some point each morning my right hand touched my right ear and the sun appeared behind me. Well, what I am now means virgin, but virgin doesn't mean lonely any more than hungry always means thin. I belt my jeans more tightly and throw my cat her meat. This is called Self-Portrait as Burnt Offering. The prophet says, I have earned a right to the voice of prophecy. I have suffered and seen the future and suffered by the seeing. I am neither a prophet nor all that good at making things up as I go. I speak in sensible tones. I observe the present moment. I record the moment's events. I review the record and say, well, I suppose that is what happened. I've learned this about memory. The fact that I can't trust it doesn't mean I should forswear it. The same is true of weather forecasts and prayer. Early on, discovered an elemental preference, the story I shy from all water and earth, the one that intrigues me, air and fire. Jehovah, angry God of an angry desert, watched smoke ascend to heaven. In that desert, the firstborn child had to be offered as a sacrifice or a sacrifice made in its place. The second child you got to keep. Smoke is Jehovah's offering, water his weapon. He killed first by flood. Movement starts from the center. Smoke ascends, water falls. In my desert and the desert of my forebears, our offering to God is water. Sweat spilled digging reservoirs and irrigation canals, the water flowing in them. My ancestors vowed to make the desert blossom. Prosperity became an offering, but not a sacrifice, the unretainable thing God demands you keep. The prophets of landscape say, our dams will outlast the water they hold. Prophecy and history flow from the present. I learned history and doctrine. I was seared by probability and logic, but never by prophecy and faith. My parents' second child, I would not be kept. I made myself the sacrifice to be offered for the first, a resentful gift evaporating like water in the desert, leaving behind defiling blackness and a stench like smoke from the charred timbers of a fallen church, from a witch writhing in the stakes, flames from a heap of smoldering books. The God I was offered to can do nothing with me but cast me away and hope there is no other God to find me precious who will hand me back to my family and say, here, I know how to sacrifice too. This is called Self-Portrait as Hungry Nude. I'm really interested in self-portraits. Everything is a self-portrait, I'm convinced. Some are just more explicit than others. This one's fairly explicit. Self-portrait is hungry nude. Bully for you. A tavern wench sporting tits firm and perky as the Grand Tetons hands you a cupcake with pink sprinkles and positions a conical yellow party hat on your head, then fingers your earlobe and tells you there will be carousing till night drops off like a coastal shelf and everyone splashes drowsily in an open sea of misplaced car keys and hastily shed underwear. Okay, so you never asked for a seat on a slab of ochre sandstone, and you don't look good in regalia. Still, when some comely minx offers to paint your fingernails, you don't pull your hand away. Above my desk is an illustration, torn from a magazine, of a self-interested nude straddling the corner of a bed. She reaches calmly to pull the bed sheets, jumbled on the floor, out of disarray. The room behind her is redolent with her various yearnings and quiet contentments. I keep her where I can see her because I admire her strong wrists, her amply capable thighs, and her expression of inward expectation. She's thinking she's hungry, I'll bet, contemplating what to have for dinner. She's not prone to extravagant outbursts of regret, and when the script calls for her to dress and depart, she will, glad to go before things get ugly. She'd no more carry resentment or false hope than she'd haul someone else's birth control pills around in her handbag. You invited me to this party, then left me alone with the punch bowl. You think I'm drained as a bathtub, cast off like anonymous panties, a bad saddle on a cranky horse. But really, I'm just hungry and deciding what I'd like for dinner, how much meat I want to tear between my teeth. This is called Christian Art. It's about losing my virginity. I compare my losing my virginity to the martyrdom of Joan of Arc. It says a lot about me. All right. St. Paul, who is often painting balding and glum, told us, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Christine, who's an idiot and not really my friend, called l'Église de Jeanne d'Arc the Jeannie d'Arc Church, which is cool, actually, in its own particular way. The theme is particular vices, strands of beads in heavy brass earrings, skulls, roses wilted in a vase, pomegranates oozing red juice, a map of the world with America, a yellow bar surrounded by blue, your reflection in a mirror, because St. Paul also wanted all of us dressed in the armor of light, which Jeanne d'Arc put on in the end, and perhaps it protected her, and perhaps it only hurt. It has to be enough to make you feverish and ill, but in a good way, really, in a way that your cheeks are always flushed, and nothing ever tastes good enough to eat, so you forget how to swallow and remember only to sing, and that's how you generate your own astonishment at the tangled way life funnels down to a dark, painful source of envy and praise. Well, that's that. Somewhere some people are singing Gregorian chants a cappella in monkish tenor voices, and if I could find anything to envy, I'd envy it with anxious deliberation. I'd praise light so busy and abundant, its surplus breeds wonder and pleasure and overindulgence, and ends in a sudden flash of blindness that never goes away. So this tour was funky for me in a number of ways. I'm gonna talk for a minute, maybe two. So spent a year and a half planning this, all excited, trying to figure out logistics, have a sick mom, fly home to Arizona to visit her, and then going to go see Joanna in San Diego and go to Claremont and start the reading. I was going to be one of the only four people to go to every single reading along the way. But unfortunately, I got really, really, really sick. I had four infections. I had a respiratory infection, I had an eye infection, I had an inner and a middle ear infection, and I could not get on a plane. My head would have exploded, and I was so upset. I'm like, I don't get to have dinner with Claudia Bushman or meet Joanna's daughters. I was really unhappy, and my mom was really sick, and so I dealt with my disappointment by doing every bit of laundry in my parents' house, and then I was going to, my parents lived in Tucson, I was going to take a shuttle from Tucson to Mesa and continue up along the way and come back to my home and my job and all these things. And what happened is that Monday night, while Claremont reading was happening, I was helping my mother go to bed, and all the strength drained from her. And I still had to go home, and I did a lot of things for my mother. I fed her. She could no longer lift a spoon. This was very sudden. She'd been ill for a long time, but only days before I heard a very confident, competent, respectful doctor say, oh, she has 6 months, at least a year, maybe more. And I was driving across southern Utah with Joanna and Susan Scott. This wonderful Community of Christ Canadian was driving, and we were in a blizzard, and I was grading freshman composition essays, and my mother's heart was trying to give out. And it took hours and hours and hours. And she died March 26th. And because of this tour, I was actually able to not be there, but to be with her before then, and to say the things that needed to be said. And a week later, I went home, and her funeral was in Tucson, which was where she was born, and it was gorgeous. It was the first weekend in April, and absolutely beautiful, not a cloud in the sky, 72 degrees, and my family was very, very upset because she was going to be buried so close to Easter, and they said, this is going to ruin Easter. It's just, you know, it'll always be tainted by the fact that she's being buried at Easter. And me, the apostate, the unbeliever who no longer is a Christian, I said, you know, she's being buried on Good Friday, and I think it would be meaningful to her, and, you know, in your belief system, at least, it worked out okay for Jesus, so maybe it'll work for Mom. And she already had the program for her funeral typed up. All we had to do was insert the date and print it out. And she had my sister singing and all this stuff, and she informed Holly, you're going to read poetry at my funeral. So I read poetry at her funeral, and I am now going to read the poems I read then. One of them I had written before, and the other one, the last one that I'm going to read, it's a funeral poem. It's sort of cheesy and sentimental and stuff, and it doesn't have a title, but this one has a title, and it's called Last Night's Fire. I've always felt I'm someone who could approach her own beheading with unvarnished resignation, no sprees of weeping or remorse, dressed, if I were lucky, in a murky red gown newly made by a servant who would miss me, if not, in a muslin shift worn fine and bleached by countless afternoons drying on mothy bushes. I'd acknowledge the crimes I'd committed without feeling I should have undone them, proclaim whatever innocence I possessed, and decline a blindfold, preferring to see the crowd and the scaffold and what was left of my future billowing out before me until the man I could only hope was strong raised a blade I could only hope was sharp and plucked the thread of my life so fiercely that it spooled immediately into a startling stuck tangle, and that was the end of that. It's what I'm doing now, envisioning an end and walking toward it, hoping it will be an endurable, appreciated death. I admit I think we all deserve that, despite our collective likeness to the sweepings of last night's fire. But always something precious is burned with whatever fuel warms us and boils water for coffee in the morning and soup at night. Always some beautiful bright trinket that should have adorned the mantelpiece dissolves among the coals, its smoke mixed with the smoke of dead juniper or pine, and carried by the wind's hocus-pocus to coat tomorrow's clouds with darkness and grime. And then this is the poem I wrote for my mother. The first sound I ever heard, the honest beat of my mother's fierce heart, is gone. The pulse that taught me steadiness and strength is still. The heart that showed my own heart how to beat, both on its own and in rhythm with another's, beats no more. For over 7 decades, it knocked on the door of the world, insistent and persistent, sure of its job, and calmly ready to do it. And when the world asked, "Who is it?" my mother said, "Marilyn." And when the world asked, "What do you want?" she answered, "Justice and truth and beauty and music and a clean kitchen and a well-made tidy bed and a carefully tended garden full of pansies and whimsy and anything that smells nice, and after that, more music, please." As the organs my mother's heart nourished, weakened and failed and shut down, still my mother's heart beat and beat and beat and beat and would not give up until it simply had no help and nothing more to do. Her other vital signs flatlined, but for hours my mother's heart beat on, direct and true as it ever had, which awes but does not surprise me, for my mother had the fiercest heart I've ever known. Fairy tales of a fair hereafter both do and do not comfort me. I plan to see my mother again, vibrant and smiling, quietly and unceremoniously generous, relaxed as a screen door, bossy as a toothache, complicated and contradictory, in short, herself. And I will understand in ways I never did before the tenderness of my mother's heart, knowing as I do now that she treasured for 50 years a single pink oval of embossed sweetheart soap. Still in its original box, the soap was from a little boy who saved pennies to buy a token to show his elementary school music teacher that he loved her for teaching him to sing. How lucky I am to have been protected and taught by my mother's fierce, tender heart. But the world's music, while still lovely and precious in all its richness, is diminished to me now that that magnificent, fierce heart and the voice it powered are no longer part of our choir. Thank you.
I hope you've been able, just from this short sample, to get a taste of what it was our privilege to participate, to play a role in and just experience for the 5 or 6 days we spent on the road together. It was an honor to be with Holly at the time of her mother's passing, and one of the probably the incomparable moments of my life, actually. We're going to close. We have some time for questions, and so we'll close this reading the way we closed every reading on the Our Voices, Our Visions tour, with a poem. One of my poems is called Invocation Benediction, and it's inspired by a crazy quilt sample that hangs over my desk that my great-grandmother, Maud Thornton, who grew up in Milan, Idaho, made. Father, mother, help me piece together the contradictions of my life. White cotton, red satin, brown polka dot, torn Sunday dress, Navajo rug, frayed baby blanket. Make me insistent on every lonely shred, willing to sacrifice no one. Where there is no pattern, God, Give me the courage to organize a fearsome beauty. Where there is unraveling, let me draw broad blanket stitches of sturdy blue yarn. Mother, father, give me vision. Give me strength to work hours past my daughter's bedtime. Give me an incandescent all-night garage with a quorum of thimble-thumbed grandmothers sitting on borrowed folding chairs. We will gather all the lost scraps and stitch them together. A quilt big enough to warm all our generations. All the lost, found, rich, poor, good, bad, in, out, old, new, country, city, dusty, shiny ones. A quilt big enough to cover all the alfalfa fields in the Great Basin. Bigger. We are piecing together a quilt with no edges. God, make me brave enough to love my people. How wonderful it is to have a people to love. Thank you. And now there's time for your questions.
Oh, Yolanda, your poetry is so beautiful. I have been, I read it in Sanskrit and Dialogue maybe 15 years ago, and I was always moved by your poetry. I was going to ask you how you and perhaps Holly, who have a somehow complex connections with the Mormon institution, claim the Mormon voice. But you know what? I think your poem just answered that question.
Maybe Holly can talk too.
What else am I? I mean, you know, it's true. I don't go to church. I don't believe. But what am I or am I not recognizably Mormon? I mean, you know, I read a poem about, you know, my ancestors being told they would make the desert blossom like the rose. I mean, you know, like what I and sure, I've experimented with other ways of calling myself. You know, even the poem I read about, like, you know, with all the Chinesey stuff, I went to Taiwan on my mission, and that's, you know, I have the surname Yu because I was Sister Yu. So, and the other thing is, you know, stop me. I claim a Mormon voice because I claim a Mormon voice. It's
no one else wants it.
Yeah, there you go. No one else wants it.
Claim it.
There are people within the Mormon community who value what I have to say. I think no one else wants it. It's a voice I come by naturally, and when I am in dialogue with these people, there are more people who listen to me than there are people who don't. That's of course not true. Most of the world doesn't listen one way or the other. But the people who tell me to shut up are never as compelling or rational or convincing as the one who say, God, you really have something worth saying. So, you know, and the other thing is, when I do, I get to talk to you guys. So why would I not come here and be a Mormon when I get to come to Sunstone and hang out with these women and talk to you?
And can I add just one more thing? It's so nice to meet you finally.
Well, pleasure to see you. I think for a long time I didn't think I was, you know, after, you know, all of us go through transitions of faith, and when I hit mine and kind of went away for a decade and kind of thought about things, I didn't feel like I was, maybe I shouldn't, or, you know, and that somehow I just never got to home with that idea. And it was becoming a mother, right, and having children, having daughters, and I'm in an interfaith family, so if I want them to claim Mormonism, I have to really actively. It's not just automatic. It's a choice I make. And because they have other wonderful tradition to choose from, too. But becoming a mother and feeling how badly I wanted them to have the beauty that I had inherited. how badly I wanted to project forward some tradition that they could feel at home in down the line. That, you know, that's what motivates me to try to write and claim the Mormon voice. It's for my Rosa and my Ella.
Yeah.
So, Holly, your story about your appearance in Colorado City was reminded when, I can't even remember the name at the moment of the feminist magazine that came out and did a feature on FMH, but I remember when the photographer came to my house about 5 minutes before, I looked at myself in the mirror and I had long hair at the time and a bun and I had a patchwork skirt down to my feet and I thought, this is, I'm representing Mormon feminism. Oh crap! I look like a polygamist. I think I changed into jeans, I can't remember. But it hit a chord with me because I realized, oh yeah, I completely look like a fundie when I lived in Salt Lake. It's often mistaken for a fundamentalist. This is kind of the project of my dreams. Unfortunately, the last year and a half of my life was completely unaware of what you were doing because I was sick. But my question is, you said you were willing to, you know, continue this, come places. So how do I get you to come where I am? How do I help organize it? Organize. How do I get you to come?
Let's talk. We'll talk. I mean, I think one of the open questions...
Other people might want to know, too.
Well, I think one of the open questions that remains for Holly and me is, how do we kind of continue to carry forward the principles that animate the vision, even if we retool the formula a bit? You know, I mean, we want to create spaces for women, Mormon women writers. We want to memorialize and collect and preserve Mormon women's writing. We want to expand institutional spaces, get some recognition for the amazing work that's being done by our writers. We want to create opportunities for younger Mormon women writers. You know, how do we do that? What's the best way forward? I think I'm as interested in listening to what, you know, you want and need as I am just like projecting forward another iteration exactly. But we'll come to Washington if you want to have us.
And I mean, there's
my house. We have lots of room. We have room now at my house.
Okay, good.
You know, we
I'll hook up the wagon.
We need the same thing everybody else does. We need, you know, time, support, and money. And, you know, Elisa arranged the stuff at Claremont. Julie arranged the stuff at UVU.
Generous from UVU.
UVU was awesome. They were really... and then the other thing is we also want, you know, we're not proprietary about this. It, also, if anybody wants to start a franchise someplace else, you know, we did not copyright the name. But we did learn some things, and we will assist with publicity and gathering participants and stuff like that. We're interested in creating community recognition, all sorts of things. So, you know, we definitely want to share the mantle and pass it on. And also, you know, we want to go hang out with you in Washington. We totally do. Speak at the microphone. If you talk in the microphone, you'll be archived forever.
It's all
we're archived now.
And say your name.
Say your name.
Poet. I'm Cheryl Capier, and in New Mexico, where I live, southern New Mexico, I belong to a creative writing class who has a poetry group on the side that I attend weekly. And so I keep hearing you say this, all this you're doing is for the young Mormon writer, and I'm thinking, what about us old Mormon writers? Are they, you know, because in New Mexico, I'm the only Mormon writer, and so in that group.
Well, Joanna mentioned this box that we carried from place to place and that has now been archived in the Salt Lake, in the
U of U
library. What I haven't confessed to her is that since she never gave me the name of the person to contact...
It's still in your apartment?
It's still in my apartment. And, you know, my mom died, and I've been busy and stuff. Okay. And so, you know... I have a crappy printer, but if you want to give me hard copies, there's room in the box. And we would love to have your stuff... And the archivist would love to have
your stuff, and it's we definitely want future generations to know what Mormon women have to say, and that includes, you know, those of us who are over 25. So, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Yay!
About 20 years ago, Lori Stromberg and I were talking with Dr. Sunstone, and Lori said to me, where are all the young women? And there were four of them. They were all in England. And it's so wonderful now to have people who are younger and vibrant, and I'm so pleased especially that you're starting things in the field that's most important to me, literature. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I don't know, maybe other people have other questions. I don't want to take over being a man. Two questions. Have you tried to network with, for instance, the Association for Mormon Letters and perhaps BYU?
The AML was really kind in helping us get publicity for the tour out, and helping us contact some writers. So, but you know, we didn't operate as a subset of the AML. You know, we didn't. So we had, you know, they helped us, but we haven't discussed any long term. But BYU was interesting. We made sure to include lots of BYU professors and on the initial call for submissions, and make sure, because, you know, there's so many fine writers, both on faculty at BYU and students writing there. And Bruce Jorgensen responded wonderfully, and one or two others did, but we didn't hear much from them after that, even at the reading that was right there at UVU. So, I mean, but, you know, those of us who work with the Mormon Studies understand institutional histories and why UVU might have been just a better spot for us in that town.
So fertile for LDS young writers. Oh. We have such wonderful writers there.
Yeah, it's incredible talent there. Yeah, and incredible support, too. They were extremely generous, so. Well, if there's nothing further, we'll all go to dinner early. Thank you so much.